You've heard me talk many times about how I feel that in this country, you and I, the average American, are not really represented by the people who are supposed to be our elected representatives, that much more of their emphasis goes to the people who are putting cash in their pockets to help them get reelected, and the lobbyists who are there spending more time with them than any constituent in this country ever gets. David Sirota writes about exactly that, how big money and corruption have conquered our government and how we take it back. That's the subtitle of his new book, Hostile Takeover. And I've asked him to join me here this afternoon on KMOX. David, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for coming on. Is money at the root of all of this political evil?
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, the issue is, you know, money has always played a role in politics. The question is you know, why is it playing such an ultimate role in this era? What's different about this era? And I would say that, you know, while money has always played a role, now it is politics. Money and politics are synonymous. We have a system of campaign finance where it's literally a legalized bribery. Politicians who want to run for office are forced, in order to run a credible campaign with enough resources, they are forced to be specialists at shaking down big money interests for cash. And so we have a government, obviously, that represents the big money interests that are funding those campaigns, those interests at the odds of constituents' interests. And that's what my book is all about, how public policy is now being used as a weapon of corporate America to bleed the middle class dry.
And speaking of the public financing, you worked for a couple of congressmen in Washington, D.C. as a staff member. I've heard that when someone gets elected to Congress, on the first day they take over their office in Washington, that's a great day and everybody's in a good mood. The next day, the fundraising begins.
That's absolutely right. But it even starts before that. What you're taught as a candidate running for office in this system is that the most important skill to have is to be able to shake down big money interests and the wealthy for cash. That's what the premium is on. That's how somebody gets ahead. It's a system rigged to select for people who are good at raising money, not people who might have the best ideas, not people who might be the most in touch with their constituents, but people who can shake loose huge amounts of cash. And that cash, obviously, comes with expectations. It's not given out of altruism. It's given with the expectation that once in office, that politician will reward the giver with legislative favors.
Can we ever get that out of there?
Well, I think we can. I think that we can't. We're never going to prevent money from being in politics. We can't because of the Supreme Court, which ruled that, and I think it's a travesty of a ruling, but they ruled it a while ago that money is speech. So you can't tell people who have money they can't spend it. But you can fight money with money. There's public financing systems of elections where candidates who qualify for the public financing system, whether through showing that they have grassroots support on petitions or other thresholds, they qualify for public money to run their campaigns. That money doesn't come with the expectation. That money is clean money. And it's not a liberal or a conservative idea. You know, states like Connecticut, which is a Democratic state, just passed public financing of elections. Arizona, a very Republican, conservative state, has a public financing of election system. This is a way to create a system where people can run for office without having to be specialists at shaking down big money interests.
Yeah, but you know what people are going to say. Hey, I don't want to have my money going to politicians just so they can run for office.
Right, and my answer to that is twofold. One is that we get what we pay for. Right now, you know, these elections are going to be paid for. They are being paid for, and they're being paid for by interests that now own our government. And we get policies on the other end of that that cost society huge amounts of money. Bankruptcy bills that gut consumer protections and allow credit card companies to charge 30 or 50% interest. An oil and energy bill that cost taxpayers billions of dollars, giving away money to ExxonMobil and all these other companies that are ripping us off. So there is a cost. The second thing is that if we have public financing, you know, we will ultimately save money. I mean, think about all those wasteful projects. Those pork projects, those come at the behest of lobbyists who give politicians campaign donations in exchange for those projects. If we actually get that money out of the system, there will be a lot less of those shenanigans. I mean, just from the beginning of my book, the intro of my book notes that this is just one example. The Toledo Blade reported that the top fundraisers in Ohio who gave President Bush $1.4 million in campaign contributions were rewarded with $3 billion in taxpayer-funded funded contracts, often from no-bid contracts from the Bush administration. So this current system is costing us a heck of a lot more than a publicly financed system would.
But you won't be able to get rid of pork completely because Ted Stevens wants to build the bridge to nowhere to get the votes of Alaskans. Robert Byrd wants to build everything in West Virginia because he wants the vote of West Virginians. That's not going to stop, is it?
Well, that's not going to stop. But I would say that, look, there's always going to be a race for money by politicians to bring back to their district. That's a separate problem. I mean, I think that's the way to stop that is to do a better job of disclosing who's putting in these projects, and then, you know, you'd hope that these politicians would be more embarrassed to try to pass a bridge to nowhere. But the more egregious problem are the projects that are going specifically to reward wealthy interests. Not just states. I mean, that's what the whole Abramoff scandal is about. Jack Abramoff, the convicted Republican lobbyist, he went to jail in part because he was trying to buy off members of Congress to then send money to his clients. Now, that's a lot different than a congressman trying to bring money back to their state. That's a lot more corrupt. That's a lot more dangerous.
Now, I want your perspective as a former congressional staffer on a story that came out this week, a new study that says that current members of Congress and their aides took free trips worth nearly $50 million in the last 5 years, paid for by corporations, trade associations, and other groups. It says some of the trips featured $500 a night hotel rooms, $25,000 corporate jet rides, visits to places like Paris and Hawaii and ski resorts in Colorado. They come to the shocking conclusion that trip sponsors appeared to be buying access to elected officials or their advisors, and they say that while some of the trips were legitimate fact-finding missions, most of them were little more than pricey vacations wrapped around speaking engagements or seminars in which the lawmaker was joined by family members.
Yeah, that's right. And I have a firsthand perspective on this. In my 5 years, I was offered scores and scores of trips when I worked on Capitol Hill, and I took one. And I took one trip, and I made sure that it was on a trip on something that I had absolutely no control over, any legislation. I mean, I was a press spokesman. So I went to Turkey, which is not exactly, I mean, it was an interesting trip. I went to Turkey right before.
Boy, you picked the luxurious ones, David.
And it was right before the war, so we spent the
good call
in central Turkey looking at military bases. But so my perspective is, look, there are very legitimate uses of these trips. The problem is the abuse. You know, the problem are the conferences in the Caribbean that are clearly designed just to be a vacation. So how do you cut out the abuse without cutting out the legitimate use? I mean, I think there's two ways to go about it. One, Congress has to do a better job of funding its own trips. And you might ask, well, why hasn't Congress done that? Well, because, you know, why hasn't Congress done that? Because they could just fund their own trips. They can just decide to do that. Well, the answer is because I think that a lot of them want the privately funded trips, because the privately funded trips are more prone for abuse to be sent to these tropical havens. So I think Congress needs to do a better job of that. I also think there needs to be a better job of disclosure. Look, I got no problem coming on your show and telling folks that I went to Central Turkey from the American Turkish Council to look at military bases right before the war on an issue that I had no legislative control or input or even relevance to what I was doing on the Hill. I got no problem talking about that. And I have no problem disclosing that. The problem is that the other trips, the Bahamas, the Caribbean, Hawaii, et cetera, the system of disclosure right now, you can't. You have to physically go to Washington, D.C. in the basement of the Capitol to find out where your members of Congress are traveling. It's not online. It's not searchable. And if the disclosure was better, there would be a big deterrent. I would feel comfortable going to Turkey, but you'd hope that other legislators and other staffers would feel not so confident about abusing the system, knowing that they could get burned.
Not only that, there's no transparency at all in us being able to see what money, where the money is coming from that they are taking in, and what they're actually spending the money on once they're getting their hands on it, is there? There's no transparency in Washington.
There's no transparency at all. I mean, we're still just a couple years out of them putting FEC reports, the election reports, online. And so this is not an accident. This is not just government reacting slowly or to something because there's red tape. The politicians specifically do not want transparency, because transparency would allow them to be burned for the abusive pay-to-play behavior that they engage in on a regular basis.
Yeah, and you know, it's so funny because they're always making rules for everybody else in America, but then they purposely make them not apply to themselves, as has happened with many labor laws. Speaking of labor, my brother worked in the Labor Department as a assistant to the secretary during the Clinton administration, and I've had him on the show as an expert on labor law many, many times, but I remember that when he was in the administration and was getting ready to leave, he had to figure out what the laws were about where he could go and how long he had to wait after leaving government. And he and I were both shocked at how it's essentially a revolving door, that you can take your political position and turn it into a huge job in the private sector, whether you're registered as a lobbyist or not. That's far too easy, isn't it?
It absolutely is a huge problem. You know, the Commerce Department, for instance, is chock full of former energy industry officials, and we wonder why, you know, our government hasn't done anything about the energy crisis. The Agriculture Department is filled with former meatpacking officials, and we wonder why, you know, nothing is done to beef up food safety in this country after a mad cow scare. HHS is filled with former pharmaceutical officials. It goes on and on. You know, William Cohen, the defense secretary under Clinton, he was just written up in an expose about how he's cashed in his experience to create a defense consulting firm for defense contractors. It's a huge problem. Government experience, public service is being sold off to the highest bidder. Public service is now seen as basically an investment to become a corporate lobbyist. Out here where I live in Montana, we're trying to do something about it. The governor out here has refused to appoint any lobbyists on state boards or in his government, and is now pushing a ballot initiative to ban state legislators from becoming lobbyists within 2 years of their service. That's a big revolving door out here. So we need more laws like that that really close the revolving door.
Let's talk about some specific topics that you hit here in the book. You expose lies and myths and half-truths about some of these, and I'll just mention some of them, and we'll kind of do a lightning round. You give me your thoughts on each
Sure.
of them. We'll start with oil and energy prices and the corruption that's part of that whole story.
Yeah, well, we hear that it's all about crude oil supplies, and the energy industry can't do anything about it. We hear that there's no price gouging. The Federal Trade Commission last week tried to tell us that there was no price gouging. Meanwhile, we were paying $3 in gasoline, $3.50. ExxonMobil made the most of any corporation in U.S. history last quarter. They paid their CEO a $400 million retirement package. Why are we hearing that there's no price gouging? Well, the Federal Trade Commission is headed by a former Chevron Texaco lawyer, who President Bush appointed a couple years ago. We're told that that this has everything to do with supply and demand. What we're not told is that internal energy industry documents, which I note in my book, show that the energy industry specifically and deliberately limited oil refining capacity to create artificial bottlenecks to drive up prices.
Now, this is an important point, and I want to go over this again, because people always talk about how come refineries aren't getting built in this country. It's the environmentalists who are keeping them from being built.
Right. That's a lie. That's another lie. There was a study that came out actually yesterday about how 12 states analyzed that claim and found that there was no delays at all for environmental permitting on refineries.
So it's that the oil companies don't want to have more refineries because that opens up capacity and makes more oil flow and the supply and demand economics get thrown off.
That is exactly right. In fact, there was a study in California that found that that energy prices before Katrina went up, gas prices went up 60 cents, 65 cents, and there was no reduction in crude oil supply. What they also found was at the very same time, oil refineries increased their profits by 61 cents per gallon. So the increased price went directly into the pocket of the oil industry. It had nothing to do with supply and demand.
Now, people say, well, if you get ethanol going and farmers have to grow corn or switchgrass or cellulosic material or whatever it is that's going to get turned into ethanol, we're going to have government subsidies to the farmers to make that happen. Aren't we subsidizing the oil companies now?
Absolutely. This cuts to a bigger issue, is whether we actually live in a free market or not. Because subsidies are anti-free market, and I would argue that we don't live in a free market, that we live in a market that is highly regulated, highly restricted, but regulated and restricted to make sure corporate profits skyrocket while the middle class gets bled dry. if we accept the fact that we don't live in a free market, then what we should be pushing for are reforms that make this not free market work for us. If it's going to be regulated, let's regulate it for us. So you're exactly right when it comes to gas prices. If we accept the fact that the oil market is not a free market, then let's shift around the regulations, in this case on ethanol, to make sure that that our energy policy actually works for a long-term sustainable future and works for our farmers.
Of course, part of the irony here in Missouri is that we have a governor, Matt Blunt, who has been pushing to get ethanol as a mandate in the state, and now we find out his brother, who's been one of his top lobbyists, is investing in an ethanol refinery.
Right, and I guess that sounds to me, and I don't know the details of it, but that sounds to me like an example where somebody might be pushing for something that might be a good public ends, but is pushing it with nefarious reasons.
Although I will say, in his defense, his brother may be a smart guy who says, "Hey, you know what? If my brother is going to be pushing ethanol for the state, ethanol is probably the future. I want to get in on that as a smart investor."
Yeah, and that's true. And look, I think that there's nothing wrong with doing well by doing good, if you know what I mean. There's nothing wrong with you know, if we can get the big companies of the world to do good things and politicians to do good things. Frankly, I don't really care what they're motivated by. I care about the outcomes. And you know, we have out here in Montana, we have an ethanol mandate. It's helped build the ethanol market out here. I think it's an important step, and I think that, but you know, the whole idea that messes with the free market, we have to understand that we don't live in a free market. We live in a regulated and rigged market, and that in order to make our government work for us, we have to make sure that that our market is regulated for us and not just for big money.
All right, let's talk about another big company involvement in another major issue that faces millions, tens of millions of Americans, and that is health insurance. A couple of days ago, the Financial Times reported that the head of General Motors, this new CEO, Rick Wagoner, wants government to get involved. He called for strong government leadership to fix America's health care crisis.
Right, and then the question for him is, where have you been? Why haven't you been talking about that for years? Although I am glad that he's now talking about that. What we have in healthcare is sheer profiteering. We have a situation where, and it's totally corrupt. The fact that no politicians talk about a universal government-sponsored, government-guaranteed healthcare system shows you how deep political corruption really runs. The fact is, polls have consistently shown that Americans, by almost two-thirds of Americans, support a universal government-sponsored, government-guaranteed health insurance program, even if it means raising taxes. That's what the polls show. This is never talked about in our political arena, our political process. That silence is corruption. That silence is bought with tens of millions of dollars of campaign contributions from the HMO and health insurance industry, bought by people like William McGuire, the guy who's head of United Health, who we found out a couple weeks ago, over the last few years has made $1.5 billion in personal compensation. That is an industry that doesn't want change, that is doing quite well with a system where we have 1 in 5 Americans who do not have any health insurance at all.
What do you think of the Massachusetts plan that now makes it mandatory for everybody in the state to have health insurance or pay a fine?
Well, I think that the mandate, that some of it is good, some of it's bad. I think the mandates that it puts on big business to pay in more to a health care system is good. I think simply making it illegal for people to not have health insurance walks us down the myth that people choose not to have health insurance. That's another big myth in our political system. Politicians say this all the time in different forms, that people who don't have health insurance are choosing not to have health insurance. Our senator out here in Montana, Senator Conrad Burns, he has said that, and then he was, of course, asked to produce one person who had chosen not to have health insurance as opposed to couldn't afford it, and he couldn't produce one. The fact is, when people say are saying that people are choosing not to afford to have health insurance, what they're saying is people can't afford health insurance.
I think what's most interesting about the Massachusetts plan is that the fines for companies not offering it to their employees will, in many cases, be less than the health insurance that they're offering. So it would actually save them money to cut health policies.
Yes, and we saw that with the Medicare bill on prescription drugs. The president promised that the Medicare bill wouldn't encourage companies to reduce the prescription drug coverage that they already provide. And what we ended up seeing was that there was that there's a provision in the Medicare bill that actually allows employers, big companies, to continue getting and expand a tax break that's supposed to encourage them to keep their health insurance, their prescription drug, that the provision actually allows companies to force employees to pay the entire cost of their drugs. So in other words, the Medicare bill actually encourages employers to dump their workers' existing health insurance and prescription drug plans.
The book is called Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. David Sirota here on the Paul Harris Show. More in a moment on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with David Sirota about his book, Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. Thank you for doing this show before you do the Colbert Report.
My pleasure.
When is that?
It's on June 14th.
So that's a week from tonight. Next Wednesday night, you'll be on there.
That's exactly right.
Have people been giving you advice on how to handle him?
They have. Everything from treat him seriously to don't take him seriously at all to make a lot of jokes. So it's going to be an interesting thing.
That make a lot of jokes thing may not work. Remember,
yeah.
it's a comedy show. He's a comedian. He's in a character.
You're absolutely right. And I go on the Al Franken show every now and again. And what I learned from being on Al's show is that whenever you're dealing with a professional comedian, if you try to make a joke, you'll quickly become the butt of the joke.
Particularly if it's on their show.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
As a show host, I can tell you, I have the control. You may be a great guest, but I still have the control over what's going to happen and how you're going to look in the long run.
That's true. That's true.
Now, speaking of media personalities, you're not a big fan of a guy I had on here a couple of weeks ago who was also pimping a book called John Stossel.
Yes. Yes, he is. He's peddling a book that purports to debunk lies and myths, but he's actually really pushing a lot of some of the most heinously deliberate lies. He pushes one, for instance, where he claims that increasing the minimum wage hurts jobs, job growth, and hurts low-income workers. It's ridiculous.
A complete fallacy.
It's a total fallacy. I mean, I can't believe that people are still saying this. I mean, the restaurant owners and some of the big businesses have think tanks to put out this stuff, but it's so easily debunked. And here's how we know it's not true. Just one example is that if you actually look at the states that have increased their minimum wage above the federal minimum, those states have created jobs at a far faster clip than states that have not raised their minimum wage. It makes perfect sense.
Yep.
You put money into the pockets of people lower on the income scale, they're going to spend it right there in your community.
Yeah.
And so the fact that Stossel, who's an ABC News quote-unquote reporter, is out peddling a book to say that he's debunking lies and myths when he's actually pushing lies and myths that are so easily debunked, it boggles the mind.
Well, I didn't take him on about that because we didn't talk about that, although I did take him on about price gouging and public schools and a couple
right.
of other things. And, you know,
he thinks energy price gouging saves lives. That's what he wrote right after the after the Katrina.
Yeah, he thought that was good because it's the free market, and I really went after him about that a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, you know, he's entitled to write what he wants, and then there are those who can come out and take him on, like you're doing in your book, and I think that's the way America is supposed to work.
Absolutely.
Are more politicians being caught up in scandals and corruption now, or does it just seem that way?
I think the scandals are higher profile because they are so brazen. That what's gone on with Tom DeLay and Duke Cunningham and William Jefferson, the Democrat, are just so easy to understand. They're not real technical. They're so brazen. They harken back to the days of, you know, cash and envelopes. That I think that that scandals might not be less or more prevalent. They just may be more outrageous and more sort of out in the open. And I think that's actually in many ways there's a silver lining to it all. That it has raised the public's awareness about how corrupt their system is. The thing I worry about, of course, is that, you know, I don't want corruption. I hope corruption, people don't think corruption is just a few bad eggs. I mean, Duke Cunningham, Tom DeLay, Bill Jefferson, they're all bad examples. But the worst forms of corruption are what's legal. The worst form of corruption is the fact that a member of Congress who chairs a committee can take tens of thousands of dollars from an industry and then go turn right around the next day and pass a law or write a law or insert a provision into a bigger bill that does that industry a favor that hurts consumers. That's entirely legal. It happens all the time. And it's because we have a system that has corruption embedded in it.
You know, we have so many of these stories that are purely designed to grab the news headlines and change our viewpoint of what's important in the world, you know, gay marriage and flag burning,
right,
and all those sort of things, when every poll shows people are concerned about Iraq and terrorism and health care and jobs and oil prices and all that sort of thing. I think too much of the debate in this country is driven. I have what I call my 80-10-10 theory, which is that 10% on the left and 10% on the right scream and shout at each other, and the other 80% of us who are not only geographically in the center of the country, but also in every other way centrist in this country, we don't get our voices heard and we don't get represented either by our politicians or by the media. What do you think of that?
I think you're onto something, and I think that what I'm probably saying it a different way, but what's happened is that the issues that should be at the center of our politics, the economic issues that government actually seriously controls and makes decisions about economic winners and losers, the economic issues and a lot of the issues of war and peace, they are depoliticized. They are considered, you know, either only topics for the business press or topics that both parties agree on. For instance, free trade and trade deals that undermine American jobs and wages, that's a bipartisan consensus issue. Those are depoliticized. The issues that I would argue that should be least political, the issues about choices between a woman and her doctor, issues of religion, these are issues that are now most politicized. And that's not by accident. Big money interests who actually really control Washington, control the debate, they would prefer the most political issues to take center stage are the ones that don't affect them in any way. They don't want the scrutiny on how our economic policy undermines ordinary people, on how our trade policy that they're profiting off hurts ordinary citizens. The more focus on those issues, the more there's a chance that those issues are going to actually be reformed. So I would say that it's really a very deliberate phenomenon.
You've mentioned wages and jobs a couple of times in this interview. What do you think is the status of the average American worker here in the 21st century?
Well, I really believe that we're going through a slow-motion depression right now. It's not as stark as the Great Depression, but if you look at the economic statistics, we now have an economy that is basically rigged to make sure that more and more of the economic benefits go farther and farther up the income chain. It used to be where, you know, rising tides lifts all boats, but if you look at the statistics, that's no longer the case. We now have, as just one example, a situation where corporate profits are skyrocketing at record rates. Worker productivity is skyrocketing at record rates, and yet workers' wages are actually declining. So think about what that means. Companies are making more money. Workers are actually, each individual worker is producing more per hour than they have before in the past, and yet workers' wages are actually declining. That means that more and more of the benefits of work are going to shareholders and executives, that is, up the income chain, rather than to ordinary citizens who are producing the benefits of those economies. And the Commerce Department found a couple weeks ago that the share of the national income going to wages is the lowest level it's been since 1966. I mean, this is a real crisis.
David Sirota's book is called Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. He talks about all the things that we've talked about in this hour, plus pensions and tort reform and big pharma and many other things. A pretty good start for your first book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Congratulations. Thanks for doing the show today. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
David Sirota here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.